Welcome back to the Oscar Project Podcast, the show where I discuss Oscar-nominated films year by year. I am your host, Jonathan Eicherberg, and today I'm bringing you an interview with Ryan Britt, author of the recently published book, The Spice Must Flow, the story of Dune from cult novels to visionary sci-fi movies. Before I jump into the interview, please be sure to subscribe to the show in your podcast player so you can get all the newest episodes as soon as they're released. If you like the interview and want to hear more, please consider leaving a rating and review in Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
Ryan Britt is a fiction and nonfiction author who has written for Inverse, Esquire, The New York Times, and StarTrek.com, among others. His first two books were Luke Skywalker Can't Read and Other Geeky Truths, and Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. He joins me today to talk about his latest book, The Spice Must Flow, the story of Dune from cult novels to visionary sci-fi movies. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first I have to ask about the title of the book. You mentioned in the book that the spice must flow is never actually said in the novels, only in the 1984 David Lynch film. Why did you decide to use that for the title?
Well, I felt like it was better than any of the other well-known Dune phrases, right? Like, I toyed with long live the fighters, but that I thought that that was maybe too violent. And then I toyed with, the sleeper must awaken, which is also kind of a transmorphification of an actual line from the book. I just went with the spice must flow because I liked the idea that it wasn't from the book, but that it shows up in some of the prequel novels. Right. And that it, I love it when there's the thing in culture that isn't accurate, but it represents the thing nonetheless, like Elementary, my dear Watson is not actually a line in that exact way in the Sherlock Holmes stories. My favorite example is the Beatles don't use their actual voices in the film Yellow Submarine, and yet it's very Beatley.
Right.
So to me, the spice must flow is the most Dune phrase ever, even though it's not in the novel. And I thought that that was sort of one of the themes of the book is about metamorphosis and change and how Dune has morphed over the years. So that's why I chose it.
Sure. Makes sense. Now, you talk a lot in your book about how Dune was somewhat a product of its time, initially releasing as a sci-fi magazine serial before appearing as the full novel. How do you think the book Dune might be different today if Frank Herbert were writing it in 2024?
I think that he probably would have gotten one of his initial ideas would have been granted, which was that the first book would have been released as three books. That was one of his initial ideas. Mm-hmm. Because when you read, I have the first issue of Analog here with me. When you read it in a magazine format, it's like a streaming TV show. You know, where you're like, oh, there's the first installment. Oh, what's going to happen to Paul and his mom? You know, and then they pick up the next part. It was like season two. Here they are in the desert. You know, they're all alone. I think that it would have a more episodic quality. And I think that you could have potentially seen the first book split up into two or three books and had those kind of been a series that people could have gotten hooked on. People forget that at the time, science fiction novels were generally much shorter. And so one of his pitches was to have it be three books, which is why in the final Dune book, you see that it has the three sections.
Yep.
Not that that was his initial plan, because he had a lot of initial plans, you know, and while Dune was being shopped around to publishers, it was also wrapping up as a serialized publication in Analog, and it was being sold. It was being pitched both as one novel and as separate novels. So there's various different sort of publication plans. And I think today somebody would be like, let's just publish it as three volumes.
Right.
And let's, you know. So in terms of content, I don't think it would be necessarily that different. Because a lot of what he was writing about is still very, very relevant. And oddly, relative to other science fiction authors, he was a lot more progressive, at least male science fiction writers at that time. Herbert is definitely more feminist than Asimov and Heinlein and a lot of his contemporaries. So I don't know. He probably would have had a sensitivity reader for some things. They probably would have asked him to really think about some of the Arabic derivations of some of the words.
Right.
But I'm not entirely sure it would be that different. Just the way it came out would be probably different.
Yeah, makes sense. And you also mentioned that the book was kind of an offshoot of some nonfiction work that he was doing about sand dunes, of course. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ecological messages of the books and how that comes through, or maybe doesn't, in the various screen adaptations we've seen?
Well, the genesis of Dune was that he was, you know, wanting to write this nonfiction article about, you know, this specific type of seagrass being used to control sand dunes in Oregon. And, you know, this practice is still used today, where sand dunes are sort of like destroyed by, you know, if the sand dunes are allowed to sort of just collect on their own, that they could sort of over time decimate certain areas. Or sometimes you just want sand dunes in a certain area because ecologically it makes more sense. Where I live in Portland, Maine, they actually use Christmas trees to keep sand dunes in place, which is very similar to the process that very similar to the process that Frank Herbert was wanting to report on in nonfiction back in the 50s. A lot of that stuff does crop up in the first novel because Liet Kynes' plan for sort of terraforming Dune is tied into these very real world ways in which dry land ecologists, as Herbert calls them, actually attempt to control nature one way or another, either to preserve it or to hold it at bay. There wasn't necessarily a moralist message behind this initially. It was more of a, wow, this is the amazing thing that humans can actually do to either curb climate change or sort of impact it. But by the time 1970 rolled around, you know, Frank Herbert was speaking at Earth Day, the very first Earth Day ever, and Dune was included in something called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was this big sort of ecological guide that was put out for people to look at different, you know, tools out in the world that may help with thinking about ecology in new ways. And so, you know, it's definitely in the first novel. And then by the time you get to the third novel, it's very prevalent, you know, because, you know, they've turned Arrakis into a paradise, but, you know, now the sandworms are on the brink of extinction, which is both an economic problem, but also an environmental problem.
Sure. Yeah.
So Herbert was, I think, always interested in pointing out that not only are we destroying the world, but we're also going to mess up our sort of economic balance if we do that as well. You know, but, you know, he walked the walk, I think, you know, in the 70s in terms of his sort of not reinvention, but his sort of like newfound passion for ecology. You know, he produced this book called New World or No World, which was also a documentary on television, in which he sort of just, you know, all he did was talk about climate change and ecology. So I don't know. I think that he was pretty serious about it. Whether or not the novels communicate that early on is sort of up for debate. But I think by the time you get to the third book, it's pretty clear where he stands.
Sure. And I know people have long talked about the debt that Star Wars owes to Dune in science fiction, but I also loved reading in your book about how things like Blade Runner and Alien might not have happened the way they did if not for various failed attempts at making Dune into a movie. So how different might the landscape of science fiction film be if there had been that 1970s Jodorowsky version of Dune you know, before any of those other films that I just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I consider the Jodorowsky Dune to be a dodged bullet for the culture. Like, I consider it to be a thing, if only because you can't imagine Ridley Scott's career otherwise. And, okay, well, how is that linked? Well, a lot of the artists and Dan O'Bannon, who basically created Alien, wouldn't have created Alien if the Jodorowsky Dune had continued to move forward in production. Because that shut down, he was available. He helped create Alien. H.R. Giger was brought over to help with the Alien stuff, as well as Chris Foss, who does all this amazing production work on Alien. So none of those guys would have been available, and they were sort of, you know, famously assembled by Jodorowsky for that. So right there, you know, you don't have. And then, interestingly, Ridley Scott was then tapped to do a different version of Dune before the Lynch one was eventually created. Mm-hmm. And he declined for various reasons. And in my book, I sort of outline those different reasons, you know, one of which he claimed that he was getting over the death of his brother. Another one is that he wanted more time. Another one is that he wanted to do Blade Runner. The other one is that he couldn't get the script right. There's a lot of reasons why. Ridley Scott's a force. You know why he does or doesn't do something is sort of a whole nother. We could talk for 45 minutes about that, about how nuts Ridley Scott is. But like, you know, I think that the world is better off with the 1979 Alien and the 1982 Blade Runner than they are with the hypothetical Jodorowsky Dune in 75, 76-ish. You know, so that's my take on it. In terms of how all that happened, I get into that in a little bit more detail in the book. But you know, anybody who's seen that documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune, and I interviewed the director of that documentary in my book, you know, will understand what a strange moment that was for Dune as an idea. But yeah, I like the timeline we're in relative to that, including the Lynch film, by the way, you know.
Sure. And obviously, we've recently had Denis Villeneuve's Dune film a couple of years ago. What do you think made that version work as well as it did, even despite coming out in the middle of COVID, streaming on HBO Max at the same time it was in theaters?
I think that I'll say something that my wife said to me at the time when we saw it, and I thought this was a really insightful comment, which is that it was a movie for adults. You know, and I think that it was it's something that science fiction in cinema often struggles with when it gets to be a big film. You know, there's plenty of small films, you know, throughout the history of science fiction cinema where we go, well, that's a great grown-up science fiction film. You know, 2001 is sort of, you know, an exception. But a lot of them still need kind of a blockbuster quality to work, Blade Runner and Alien included. You know, and then to say nothing of, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek films and things like that. But there's something contemplative and thoughtful and artful about the Denis Villeneuve Dune that makes it seem more like an indie flick. And I think because of that, and because it doesn't have somebody sort of yucking it up like a Guardians of the Galaxy or even like a Han Solo, it has a few one-liners. You know, Jason Momoa gets to be a little bit, you know, funny, and as does, you know, Josh Brolin and stuff. But for the most part, it is not a movie with a lot of silliness in it. It takes itself very seriously,
right,
in a way that is, like, honestly just kind of rare. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's just not that common. You know what I mean? Like, and you'd think that it would be more common. You're like, well, what about Black Mirror? And I'd be like, that's a TV show. It's like, what about Foundation? It's like, that's a TV show. What about For All Mankind? Well, that's a TV show. They're all great. You know what I mean? But it's kind of like you really only see that adult approach to science fiction combined with the big stars and combined with the blockbuster thing in these Denis Villeneuve movies, because Blade Runner 2049 is another good example. But I think that the fact that it dared to take itself seriously and it dared to be ponderous, and, you know, I was joking with somebody the other day, you're 30 minutes into the movie before we actually get the first scene from the book, which is where Paul is tested by the Reverend Mother. That's the first scene in the book. That's the first scene in the first magazine issue in Analog. There's 30 minutes of buildup to that in the film. The film is just, I don't know. I think that connected with people because it was so unique. Because it was like, oh my God, look at all these amazing actors that everybody loves. You know what I mean? From Chalamet to Jason Momoa to Rebecca Ferguson to Charlotte Rampling. You know what I mean? Like the royalty of acting. And then it's this really interesting film. So I think it it's also a great introduction to Dune for people that know nothing about it. So I think it was just it's a very unique film. And I think the second one, when people see it, I've seen it, it's fantastic. I think they'll be like, whoa. But it's, I think it's essentially just the same movie, but more of it, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And that kind of preempts my next question, which was going to be what to expect from the second one. But if you've already seen it,
what I'll say is don't assume that you know everything about the story.
Gotcha.
And I think that Villeneuve makes some interesting choices with the adaptation that will be controversial, but surprised me. But ultimately, you know, the fidelity is still to the basic story. You know, I Chalamet's Paul doesn't make it rain the way that McLaughlin's does in the 84 version. But
Okay.
There are some eye-opening, shocking choices. I'll say that.
Very good. Well, hopefully that gets people interested. So you had a few things listed in the references at the end of your book. Were there any specific books or articles or anything that people should check out if they want to go even deeper on Dune?
Well, I mean, at the same time my book came out, there was a great oral history by Max Every called A Masterpiece in Disarray, which was just about the 84 Lynch film. So Max's book, I would say, is like the exact opposite of mine, because mine is like, how do I condense the entire Dune franchise into 300 pages and just get people pumped about it? But also, you know, I wanted to do the publication history and talk to people that nobody had ever talked to, like Frank Herbert's widow, Theresa Shackelford. And I really wanted to, you know, do the whole I wanted to talk about the Sci-Fi Channel versions, which people rarely. So, you know, I talked to John Harrison, who directed those. Max did the opposite thing. He's like, how do I make the longest book possible about one version of Dune? And so I really admire that. And I correspond with Max every now and again. And I think that his book is really great. I think that, you know, the Brian Herbert. You know, my references are essentially source references in the back of, like, that's any quote that wasn't original that I didn't get from an original interview, that's where you can find out where I got them from. You know, that's just standard practice of what you're supposed to do when citing sources. But I think that Brian Herbert's biography of Frank Herbert is good. And you, if you really want to know about Frank Herbert, you should read it. I will say that I enjoyed finding all the things that were left out of that in terms of, like, because I set out to write a book about Dune and not a book about Frank Herbert, sure. You know, and I think that that's an essential difference. But I would recommend those. I also like, you know, there's a book that I pulled some Ridley Scott quotes from that's called Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner. That's one of my favorite behind the scenes science fiction journalism books ever. That's a really cool book. I would recommend that. I think that answers that question.
Yeah, that's good. I'll be sure to link to as many of those as we can in the show.
Yeah, Max's book is new, so I would recommend that very, very strongly.
Gotcha. Yeah. Very good. So before we move on to questions not related to the book, is there anything else you want to touch on about this book specifically?
I think that the one thing that I just want to say about it is that, you know, again, like, you don't have to know anything about Dune to read my book. You know, and if you're okay with spoilers, then that's going to be part of it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, it's, you're going to get spoiled on Dune Messiah. You're going to get spoiled on Children of Dune, you know. But I think that one thing about my book that I tried to do was to dispel this myth that Dune is somehow unapproachable and dense and, like, hard to get into, because I just don't think that that's true. Right. I think that, like, it's a very accessible, very fun, interesting saga. And yes, I don't, you know, dwell as much on the expanded universe of the Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson books, but I also give you, I think, enough of what you need to know about them to talk. And so I would say that my Dune book is the cheat code for people who want to get into Dune. And if you want to know more, it's all there,
right?
You know, I'm telling you what to watch and what to read. And if you don't want to know more and you just want to read the first novel and watch the new movies, then I think that my book will make you it's like taking the spice, right? Where you will get all the knowledge from the ancestors, you know, that Jessica gets when she takes the water of life, I guess would be more accurate. So you'll get more knowledge instantly without having to work too hard at it.
Perfect. Makes sense. So this might be the hardest question I ask. You've obviously watched a lot of films in your career, but if you had to pick your top three, what would they be?
Yeah. So I thought about, I'd say Blade Runner is in the top three, maybe not top. Even Kyle MacLachlan in my book mentions that he prefers Blade Runner to the 1984 Dune, which I think is hilarious. But I think Blade Runner just never gets old for me, any version, really. I mean, I obviously prefer the version without the voiceover, but I think Blade Runner is one of those movies that always makes me excited to create things. I will say The Life Aquatic, the Wes Anderson film. I find that to be a wonderful blend of humor and just filmmaking in general. It's just one of my absolute favorite movies. And I would say, because I'm a journalist and because I'm interested in nonfiction and its intersection with fiction, the Charlie Kaufman film Adaptation is absolutely one of my favorite films. And I probably think about it on a daily basis as a writer. you know, so those would be mine if I had to really, really. You know, if I was like, if there was like a fourth film, it would probably be The Wrath of Khan, just because it influenced me so much. And it contains so much literature that I'm interested in, like Dickens and Sherlock Holmes and stuff.
Fantastic. Now, on a fun side, if you could invite any three movie characters to your next dinner party, who would they be and why?
I think that if we're talking exclusively, I want to say James Bond, even though he's not exclusively a movie character. He's also a book character, but I'm going to put Bond on there because I'm obsessed with sort of deconstructing Bond. And also I just feel like he would be able to make you the best drinks and be able to tell you why. And I think that Bond gets a bad rap. So I'll put James Bond on there. I will put Princess Leia, just because she's funny. She could rule the room. You wouldn't really have to like do anything. You would just kind of like listen to her. I think that would be kind of awesome. And then I'll cheat again a little bit and just say Data from Star Trek, even though he's in the TV shows, but he was in four films, sure. Just cause Data's hilarious and Data cracks me up. And Data also knows everything. And unlike the AI menace that we actually face, Data is a self-contained, he's not in the cloud. You know what I mean? Like he's his right. own thing. And I think that that's really an interesting idea. And there's so much Asimovian things about Data that I love. Like Data, like right after he's like hooked up with the Borg Queen in First Contact, I would want to talk to that version of Data. Gotcha. He's like kind of cocky, you know, but he's also still has that innocent Data-ness.
Sure. That'd be a good one. Good choices there. Now, do you have any books you might be able to recommend that you've read recently? Nonfiction, fiction, and obviously don't necessarily have to be about movies.
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot and I write a lot about things. I'm reading a bunch of stuff right now. I'm rereading the Three Body books because they're being turned into the Netflix show. And so I strongly recommend those to anybody. Really epic, weird sci-fi, you know, just excellent. I know that everybody loves those, you know, Barack Obama has a blurb on the cover of them. So I'm not like changing the game by recommending those books. I'm reading a book that hasn't come out yet, called The Winner by Teddy Wayne. He's a great, contemporary novelist, and it's this sort of like psychological drama, about like a tennis pro dealing with like rich people. And it's just got like this really great sort of social commentary. Teddy's really good at this kind of stuff. He had a great novel called The Great Man Theory that came out a few years ago. So that's just a good fiction novel that I'm just really enjoying. And then I just got Kim Sherwood's new James Bond novel, actually, talking about Bond again. Kim Sherwood is this English writer. She's been doing these Bond continuation novels that are kind of like a reboot of that mm-hmm. continuity. That are really updated. It's all about these other secret agents that are like work with Bond, and they're kind of the focus. Her first one was called Double or Nothing, and it came out last year. And this is the sequel called A Spy Like Me. And they're just really cool, like cool POV characters, and just they have like a cinematic quality. And it really should be where they go with those films, though I imagine they probably won't.
right.
But yeah, those are just a few things I'm reading right now.
Excellent. We'll be sure to link to those as well. Yeah. And last thing before we wrap up, I'm sure you've got some promotion for the book planned around Dune Part 2 movie.
Talking to you. No, it's just joking.
What other projects do you have lined up next, and where can people follow you on social media to get updates?
Well, I'm on Twitter. I'll still keep calling it Twitter. And I'm on Instagram primarily. And yeah, the Dune book is going to be, The Spice Must Flow, my book, will be out in people's world a lot in the next few months. I'm going to be at the Tucson Book Festival on March 9th in Tucson, Arizona, promoting both The Spice Must Flow and also talking about my Star Trek book, Phasers on Stun. But I actually cannot talk about the next thing that I have lined up, unfortunately.
Right.
It is unfortunately top secret, and I actually don't know. and I actually don't know what form it will take or if it will happen. But there is another thing that I am doing, and it is involving properties that people are familiar with. But that's all I can say.
Very good. Well, it's we'll have to keep an eye out for that when it comes and when we get more information from you. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for the time today. I really appreciated you taking the time to speak with me and for sharing all the information and great stories from the book.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it.
Thank you again to my guest today, Ryan Britt. His newest book is The Spice Must Flow, The Story of Dune from Cult Novels to Visionary Sci-Fi Movies. And I'll have a link to where you can pick that up in the show notes, along with links to the movies and books mentioned throughout the interview. The Oscar Project podcast is written and produced by me, Jonathan Eichelberg, with editing assistance from Joshua Eichelberg. I have a few more interviews with current Oscar nominees lined up in the coming weeks, so please keep an eye out for those. And until then, I hope to see you at the movies.